Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one, welcome all to the DNP Show, delivering the truth and exposing the lies on freedomizerradio.com. My name is Paul Dayton, and I'll be flying solo tonight. Unfortunately, my co-host, Diana, will not be able to make it this evening. As we all know, she's very involved in all kinds of causes and committees, and she's very involved in everything, and so she doesn't always have time to make the show. Which is our loss, but we will carry on without her. If you're tuning in to hear Dave Franklin, candidate for town council in District 6 in New York State, he, along with Diana, will be back next week. So tune in then. If you're listening to old shows, you can always go to pauldayton.us. If you're listening to this podcast, say, weeks or months or even a year after it occurred, go back to pauldayton.us. You can find every episode of this show, along with other articles and shows on which I've been a featured guest, and Diana's health stuff, hopehealth.begoodinside.com, where you can find that there. Last week, we had on the wonderful guest, Diane Sayre, who's a candidate for the federal Senate seat in New York State, and it was a real pleasure to have her, and I thought that went pretty well. I mean, she came on, and, you know, she touted central planning in the name of liberating the masses. And all we did was sort of gently state some facts that showed that to be nothing but insulting falsehood, and just sort of we kept it very civilized. So I think that that went pretty well. If you want to tune into that show, if you missed that, again, check it out, pauldayton.us, or wherever you listen to your podcast, the show with Diane Sayre. And by the way, her website is Sayre for Senate, S-A-R-E-F-O-R, Senate.com. So we will still, when we have a guest on like that, we'll still promote the guest, and I think that's the way to do it. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. We know that you have so many options out there to listen to everything. Everything's so much more convenient now, which is wonderful. And so I thank everybody for any amount of time they devote to our show. If you want to call in, the phone number is 319-527-6208. That's 319-527-6208. If you push 1, that lets us know that you wish to come on the air and say hello or say something else, and that's wonderful. You know, we get listener feedback. You know, people email me on pauldayton.us. I do see people out in the world. People contact Diana, I know. And I know we have a listener called Nate Jamie, who is in the Las Vegas area. And truth be known, has been was a boyhood chum of mine, and we've maintained acquaintance over the years, and he says that he listens. He said it often enough that I mentioned things so that I believe him, that he listens, he's not just being nice. So I want to thank you, Nate Jamie, for listening and carrying on. He's a real good guy, if you happen to know him, one of the greatest, most resilient people with great strength of character. Wonderful person, Nate Jamie in Vegas. So thanks for listening to the show, and thanks, everybody. All right, so let's get on with it here. Normally, Diana will do a few headlines. And we will do a couple of headlines here as well. Right now I'm on, truth be known, jellyfish.news, which is the John B. Wells sort of news source. And I'm a fan of that show, and I was actually fortunate enough to be a featured guest as well. So I dig that show. And so since I am doing the headlines myself, I will just come here and we'll see what we see here, what we have. Healthcare workers picket outside U.S. hospitals in multiple states, kicking off a 3-day strike. So that's unfortunate news. Let's learn more about that. In the first place, a strike, you know, monopolies are horrible, no matter whether they're comprised of employees or of producers. You know, people call it a labor union because they think it's different from a monopoly. A monopoly in practice only exists, by the way, when the state, that is, when government enforces it. Often government creates it in the first place, much like in the New Deal when we have the dairy producers monopoly created and perpetuated by the AAA, which is not the car club. I was talking about the NRA, by the way, with somebody at one point in the recent past. Which is the New Deal program, the National Recovery Administration, which was a horror show of tyranny and oppression. That one bureau itself in 1 year generated 7,500 pages of new federal legislation when prior to Roosevelt taking office, in a century and a half, the entire nation had produced around 2,000 pages of federal statutes and to encompass all areas and all matters. In 150 years, approximately 2,000 pages of federal statutes. Frank and the New Dealers come in, and one bureau alone, in one year alone, more than three times as much, right? 7,500 pages of legislation. It's horrible. But people don't realize that, you know, it's just a concentration of it's a small group, only exists because government puts it there and gives it power, gives it legal authority, which has the power to exclude all others, not just today, not just the day the legislation is passed, but for as long as the legislation is in existence. So that is, if we're talking about dairy producers, again, these producers had always colluded in small groups. You know, they get in the back of a room someplace and they say, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to fix our prices. You know, the three of us and our three major dairy concerns are going to fix our prices and we're going to collude. And they would do that for a while, weeks, sometimes months. But then one would always go behind the back of the other and betray the other two in order to make more money for themselves personally. And by what measure, by what means would this be done? Out there, I'll give you a minute to think it over, just a few seconds. If we've all agreed to keep our prices high and with my former competitors, and I want to get an advantage over my competitors who I know, who I expect to keep their prices high, I could lower my prices. That's what they would always do. So the consumer, the people always benefited. The world just took care of it. The individual desire for personal gain would cause them to betray the others in the scheme and to lower their prices. And then the others in the scheme would follow suit, and then the monopoly would be, the attempt at monopoly or price fixing would be broken up. The same is true of railroad rates. The same is true, and by the way, the railroads did that for decades and decades until the ICC, the Interstate Commerce Commission, codified that monopoly into existence, forbidding new people from entering as competitors, not just that day, but for to this day, forever, until the legislation goes away, which has not to this day gone away. So that, again, is always the case. The same thing with a job holder's monopoly, known labeled as a labor union. What these people do, I mean, people should be able to freely choose to join together, right? If there's 50 people or 100 or 10,000 or 100,000 or however many, if they want to voluntarily choose to collude with each other and to have solidarity, and that they as a group will, you know, all not work if they don't get paid what they want, then they can do so. They can pay themselves. They can tax themselves. They call it union dues. It's just a tax you pay. They can tax themselves to their master. And, you know, the master can be responsible for sort of a war chest to fund the people while they don't work. And that's fine. That's all fine with me. When government comes in and says, you have the authority now, the right, the legal right, the word right is so bizarre, it should be in quotation marks, right? We're giving you legal license, I'm gonna use that word because it's more appropriate, to urinate all over someone else's private property rights, right? We're going to say that you, the workers, the employees, can dictate who can and cannot work at a business that you definitely do not own. You definitely did not start it. You definitely did not buy a controlling interest, and now it's yours because you purchased it fair and square. You're basically just, government is picking the pocket of the minority, that is the business owner, to attempt to purchase votes of these employees in this fashion. And what's bizarre to me, so what is not surprising, because somebody will always point out to me and say, Paul, well, how do you reconcile what you're saying with what you're saying, that union monopolies are bad for the worker as a class? They'll always say, well, Paul, how do you reconcile that with the fact that union workers statistically have like the highest pay and the most time off and so forth? To which I respond, what should be the obvious answer. It's alarming that this is not obvious. The obvious answer is that when government gives a handful of people authority to exclude the majority, the overwhelming majority of the worker, that small minority that's been given unearned, undue authority, licensed by government to steal from rightful property owners, that is the business owner, that that small group should do well is not a surprising outcome. When you have something that by law and systematically excludes, as far as I know in the United States, not even 1% of the population has ever been a member of a single labor union. So that what you have is 99%, literally 99% or more of the labor force is forbidden from working there at all. The union monopolies tightly and jealously suppress the number of jobs available. They tightly and jealously forbid people from learning how to do more than one thing so that they can better themselves, be a better worker, maybe graduate to being their own boss, or do other things and just improve. So it keeps the workforce down in that way. Even the people who are in the little monopoly are holding themselves back in terms of competency by these very measures. And again, they're forbidding the overwhelming majority of the worker to be involved, to work there at all, at any rate, under any conditions, in any terms, at any time. So I find that fascinating, that something that forbids 99% or more of the working class, right, that class, that classification or element or proportion or whatever synonym you want to use, that forbids 99% of said people from working a job, benefits the workers as a class. That anybody could believe such nonsense is fascinating. So anyway, we have these people. They're starting a three-day strike, which is interesting that normally when they do this, so they go take over a business they don't own and they forbid people from going in and so forth. And they can even dictate, and this is the New Deal, by the way, who made this so, they could dictate who can and cannot be on the premises. That is forbidding. Imagine you hired somebody to come mow your lawn at your house where you live, right, you the listener. You hire somebody to come mow your lawn, and because you hired them and you paid them what you agreed to pay them, they now say that they own your house. They can decide how much you're going to pay them. If you don't pay them the terms that they want, then they can say that, you know, you cannot be in your house. They can be in your house whenever they want. They don't have to buy it from you or anything. They're just going to steal it from you until, like a child pouting, until you give them what they want. How incredibly unjust. The same is true of your car. You hire somebody to you know, give you an oil change on your car or whatever, and they say, this is my car now. Because you hired me, now I can take your private property that you own fair and square in real life, and myself and some politicians come up with some nonsense and call it a right, that I have a right to urinate all over, a pretend right, to urinate all over your actual rights. So that's how that works. So what are these people doing here? It says, tens of thousands of Kaiser Permanente workers took the picket lines in multiple states on Wednesday, launching a massive strike that the company warned could cause delays at its hospitals and clinics that serve nearly 13 million Americans. So already, right here, are we benefiting the masses or are we harming the masses? We are preventing 13 million Americans from access to these hospitals. So definitely the answer. So that 10,000 workers can try to get their way. So clearly, again, this is not helping the masses, it's harming the masses, clearly and obviously. The Coalition of Kaiser Permanente Unions. What a name. What a name. The Coalition of Kaiser Permanente Unions, representing about 85,000 of the health system's we'll call it 100,000. 100,000 people are urinating all over 13 million. That is the people who don't own the hospital. They're just preventing them from getting the care that they're supposed to have if they want to pay for it. Even if they want to buy it, they can. It's a disgrace. So anyway, this coalition of monopolists represents 85,000 health systems employees. Nationally approved a strike for 3 days in California, Oregon, Colorado, and Washington. Good freaking Lord. So what are their demands here? Coalition. We don't ever want to be in a situation where the nurses have to do our job. Right. So again, we have an instance in which they're having strict, very strict segregation of the workers in terms of what they can and cannot learn. Right. Suppressing worker competency as a whole is clearly the case. The strike comes in a year when there have been work stoppages with multiple industries, including transportation, entertainment, and hospitality. So that's that. You have a case of a monopoly. Now, if these people wanted to freely choose to organize and behave this way, and the employer can say, okay, fine, I'll just replace the entire staff. Have a nice life. I'm not putting up with this. This is my business. I don't need you. I had this business before I ever met you. I'll have this business after you die. If you died right now, the business would go on. It's mine. I don't need you. You need to know your place. That would be fine. And if a new staff was horrible and they had to go crawling back to the old staff who quit to try to hire them and give them what they want, then fine. Freedom is the key. Liberty is the key, right? Private property rights. When you have somebody with no risk to themselves, that is, they don't actually risk losing their job, they really are not courageous. They're just a punk. Right? It's sort of like those movies where somebody's supposed to be a real big tough guy, but they won't actually fight anybody one-on-one. The scumbag will only hit somebody when two or three of his henchmen are holding the other guy's arms behind his back, right? That's basically what you have here, right? You have gutless punks masquerading as strong and brave individuals. So that's that. And in fact, that's all the headlines I plan on doing right now. Because as you know, I don't really keep up with the headlines, and I spent that much time on them, and I already am done with it. So we'll continue on with the show here. And what I will say is that, so when we had Ms. Sarah on last week, she mentioned, I thought we were pretty nice to her. We didn't jump all over her. We didn't, rub her nose in every single incorrect thing that she said. She engaged in some demagoguery. We just pointed out that some of it was false. And then let her make her statements. We permit the audience to make their own decisions. We have enough respect for our audience that they can do so. She mentioned colonization, and she portrayed colonists, the usual demagoguery of they come in and they rob the land and the inhabitants of all of its resources and money, and they plunder, and they take it back away someplace else, harming these poor, poor colonized, the natives in the area, which, of course, is historically not often the case. In fact, frankly, it's more often the opposite of that. After all, a nation doesn't try to colonize a place just so that they can, be a jerk to the people who live there. It's because they want to do something useful with the area, or think they can do something useful. It could be just for military strategic purpose, militarily strategic purpose, right? That could be what they're after. But often it's so that they can try to, create markets where markets did not exist before. During the 19th and 20th century, British colonies in Africa on the Gold Coast, when you have the case of children in school. So from 1900 to 1909, there were 3,000 African children in schools in the Gold Coast, 3,000 for that decade. By 1950, once the Europeans had been there, once the British had been there for a while, 150,000 of the African children were in schools, up from 3,000 in nearly half a century. Gold Coast travel and transportation was also improved greatly. In the 1890s, there were no rails and no roads. By the 1930s, there were rails and railroads. So that is, they went in with their own money, with outsider money, and they put in this capital to install these railroads, which, by the way, were going to outlive the length of the colony. So that is a net gain for the people who live there. Travel and transportation required fewer hours than had previously taken days. So that is, before in 1890, it would take somebody 5 days to travel from point A to point B. However, by 1930, it would take them 3 hours to travel the same point A to same point B because of this rail that was put in by the British, because with the British's own money, with their own funds, in an effort to try to make something useful of this basically backwards land. British West Africa, slavery and slave trading virtually were eliminated during colonization. The British, or what's called the West, our leader, the United States, was right behind the British in terms of sequence, in terms of major powers, was not far behind the British in eliminating and suppressing slave trade, of course. That's another key that people don't really say, don't really tell the whole truth, right? By the 1930s, Nigerian trade hubs had switched from slave trading to groundnut trading, right? So the same people were probably still there, doing their as sort of merchants, Nigerian merchants, but the product changed. They switched the market. So So instead of trading humans as chattel slaves, they started trading food, which also incentivized people to grow and cultivate the food and transport it and so forth. Health and life expectancy for Africans soared, along with quality of life. Exports from sub-Saharan Africa rose in its proportion of tropical trade from 6.2% of tropical trade in 1913, climbing to 13.3% of said trade by 1937, and reaching 18.2% of all tropical trade by 1955. That is, sub-Saharan Africa before, I mean, was hardly trading anything, right? 6%, comprised 6% of the trade. Now they were almost one-fifth in approximately half a century. These are all very beneficial factors. What goes on more? Writing in 1926, writer Alan McPhee describes it as the superimposition of the 20th century after Christ onto the 20th century before Christ in his tome, The Economic Revolution in British West Africa. So, and that's right. So they went to this backwards place. It was more or less isolated. And I've been on other times talking about the reason Africa is so backwards, has been so backwards, with its proximity to Europe, sort of left behind, is because of its geography, not because of some kind of anti-black, you know, conspiracy theory encompassing all ages at all times, and that's why the blacks in Africa were left behind. That's not the case. That's not even slightly the case. It's something you learn in middle school, right? Africa, though it is surrounded by water, if you look at a map of the world, if you look at the coastline closely, then you find there aren't really any ports or harbors, right? The coast is more or less straight, sort of straight up and down, so that the waters were too rough and it was almost impossible, certainly not enticing, to try to land a boat. Really anywhere in Africa other than to come right up through the north from Europe. Sometimes people landed on the south point, but all the rest of that coastline was basically unusable based on the technology of the time. They didn't even have motors. You have to keep in mind, they had no motors. Right? They were at the mercy of the waters and currents. And so that was so what you had is more or less, and the northern Africans were very like violent and combative, just like people all over the world. It's not because Africans or blacks are particularly savage. That's not the case. It's because that's the history of the world. The Indians were that way. When Europeans came to America, in East Asia, they were always that way. When the other East Asians would come by, or when Europeans came by, especially unknown people, like the most common outcome for strong people, people who perceive themselves as strong nations, was one of not unwelcoming, right? Violent. We're going to keep you out. We're going to attack you. In fact, we're going to try to beat you and rob you for what you have in some cases. However, the weakest, the people who were sort of at the mercy of the stronger nations, this is true in the American Indians, and it was also true in other areas as well, those people were more likely to be welcoming to newcomers because they sought allies against the big bad, powerful nations in their geographical region. So anyway, what you had was relative isolation in Africa. And this writer describes them as being living in a state of the 20th century before, 20th century BC, 2000 BC, in terms of their technology. And, you know, the Europeans came and colonized, and they brought them forward, you know, 4,000 years, according to this. This is probably taking some liberty. But not that much, really not that much. I mean, there's hardly any mechanization in Africa prior to that time. The wheel, as we know, was unknown in certain parts, the most backwards parts of Africa until the mid-20th century. So that's the case. So again, it's a net benefit, the colonization in Africa. And frankly, the biggest negative imparted to the Africans from the Europeans certainly was the presently fashionable heavy-handed central planning style of government, right? Swindling people, telling them that, putting shackles on the populace and telling them that these shackles were in fact held their liberation, right? Take away their money, create monopolies in the name of shielding them from monopoly, tax the hell out of them in the name of helping them. makes slaves of them, right? Rule as a tyrant. And the installation of these governments, once the Europeans began leaving in the middle of the century, the middle and the end, towards the end of the 20th century, in parts of Africa, was in fact, that was the bad part. That's what was bad for Africans, was like basically New Dealerism, or central planning, or American liberalism, wokernism, communism, socialism, whatever you want to call it, concentrating the power into the hands of the few by decree in the name of the liberation of the mass. And just a few more notes on this before we hit the break at the top of the hour. As of 1980, transport beyond the rudimentary remained entirely dependent upon rails built and kept by foreigners. This is in Africa. During colonization of British West Africa, all agricultural exports produced by West Africans on farms which were their own, more often than not. So that is, these people who were once these backwards people running around in the jungle or whatever they were doing, messing around, now they were business owners. They owned their own farm, in which they not only had subsistence production, that is, they could feed themselves in their village or whatever, but they also could sell it. They had cash crops. They could export it. We had business owners, making business owners of the people of West Africa. How that harms them, I'm really not sure. In real life with real people and real money, but in real life with real people and real money, that is what actually happened. So again, always watch out for unsubstantiated claims and T-shirt slogans, and always prefer people who speak the language of evidence. So that's that. And I really want to thank everyone for being here again. You are listening to D&P, Delivering the Truth and Exposing the Lies, on freedomizerradio.com. You may be able to hear some appliances going off in the background, which is a little annoying, but nonetheless is occurring. We will be back in a few minutes, just a few short minutes, to resume with the second segment of the show. You're listening to D&P, Delivering the Truth and Exposing the Lies. This is Paul Dayton flying solo. Diana will be back next week. Hang tight.
That's right. The Jokers and Jesters Comedy Tour is back on the road. We are currently promoting our second Amazon Prime special, Jokers and Jesters, the next special. We will be touring small towns across this great country of ours. So for our tour dates, follow us on Facebook at Jokers and Jester Comedy Tour or at our website, jokersandjester.com. It's a great night of music, laughter, and magic. Don't miss us as we come to a small town near you.
Thanks for stepping into umpire, Mr. Fletcher.
Well, I'm an English teacher, not a phys ed teacher, but I'll do my best.
You'll do fine. Just call the kids safe or out. And keep an eye on them right there. They've been trying to steal.
Who, him?
No, we use the kids' preferred pronouns. He's on second. I mean them.
There's only one kid there. Who's them?
They are.
He is?
No, they is. He's on second.
You mean her?
Don't call me her. I'm a him.
That's a he. The kid on third uses she.
He uses she?
No, she uses she.
And you want me to keep my eye on them?
Yes.
But especially him.
No, keep your eye on them. They've been trying to steal.
Who's they? Him, her, and him?
No, not him and her. Just them. Their pronoun is there. And they're right there.
I'm an English teacher. I get pronouns. That's him, her, and him.
No, that's them, him, and her.
Excuse me, but now I identify as him.
He's gender fluid. He used to be she, but now she's him.
Huh?
And I'd like to change my pronouns to Z, Zim, and Zer.
Now Z wants you to call Zer Zim.
What's a Zim?
Don't call Zim a what? Now Z is offended.
Look, I don't want to offend anybody. I'll call them by their names. Kids, what are your names?
I'm Addison.
I'm Addison. Addison.
Their parents are millennials. They named them all Addison.
Well, why do I have to use preferred pronouns?
Because gender is a social construct, and I was born this way.
How can he be born that way if gender is a social construct?
Whoa, 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 whoa. Don't question their identity, or his, or Zer's. Just follow the rules and call them they.
Who makes these rules?
They do.
This they?
No, not that they. They.
Huh?
They will get you fired if you don't use the right pronoun. They will kick you off of Twitter if you question their beliefs. They cancel comedians to defend them. They get rid of professors with different points of view.
But who's they?
Nobody knows who they are. We just have to listen to them.
Yeah.
Hey, if you liked that video, you can help us make more videos like that by joining the Babylon Bee YouTube channel for just $4.99 a month.
Become an exclusive subscriber. You get videos, you get full-length podcasts that are often twice as long as the one that you've been seeing.
Do it now. Smash the join button, and you can become a member, a Bee Superfan, and you'll be a lot cooler than everyone else.
Ay, ay, ay. Le chupacabra. Okay.
Are you tired of losing your herd of goats to the chupacabra? Are you worried about how you're going to eat because your goats were viciously ravaged? Call SNL Chupacabra Insurance today. SNL provides fast, speedy claims in the event of your goat farm being destroyed. Low rates, fast service, and professional attitude is what makes SNL your choice for chupacabra insurance. Call 855-CHUPA-NO today. 855-CHUPA-NO for a free rate quote. SNL Chupacabra Insurance. Just in case the chupacabra comes.
Ay, ay, ay. Le chupacabra.
Welcome back to the show. This is DNP delivering the truth and exposing the lies. This is Paul Dayton flying solo with you here. You're tuning in to hear Dave Franklin, candidate for town council for District 6 in New York State. He will be on next week. Diana also will be on as well. She, if you missed the beginning of the show, Diana is unable to join us tonight. She's very busy, as we all know. She's involved in all kinds of committees and causes, and she's very busy all the time. So she's unable to make the show tonight, but we do miss her, and we are looking forward to having her back next week. So with that, we let you know that we are on Freedomizer Radio. We're also available on iHeart, and we still have a couple people listening, but it looks like they don't, in terms of calling in, but they have not pushed one to speak. If you want to call in, the number is 319-527-6208. That's 319-527-6208. And push the number 1 to indicate that you want to come on the air, if you do. Otherwise, I don't know what people do. Maybe they, I don't know why they like to, sometimes we have people listening, but they don't want to come on the air. I wonder if their phone signal is stronger than their internet signal where they are, or what causes that. But nonetheless, we're happy to have everybody. You can also check us out on iHeart, where the podcasts are always available, and you can go to pauldayton.us, where you can find every episode of this show, along with other articles, and Diana's site, where she has her health stuff, so that's very cool, pauldayton.us. Thanks for joining us. Next up, we're going to shift gears a little bit here from colonialism into, the 1920s in the United States, which is an important period. A lot happens during the 20s. We have the Fed, that is the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, which was established in 1913 in the United States, really sort of sat on the sidelines until after the war, the Great War, was over. And more or less, they kind of just sat and watched. During the war, of course, we saw the Aldrich Vreeland Act, which I cover in my first book, which was a solution to the bank problems, which worked like a charm. There were no restrictions on conversions of deposits into currency. Like, that is, if you had $100 on deposit at the bank, you were able at all times to take out $100 worth of currency if you wished, which was different from the other episodes I cover in 1907, in 1893, and 1873, in which there was a restriction on that in certain parts of the country, not nationally. So anyway, it was better in that way. However, it was not used again by the New Dealers or by Hoover, or the Fed, frankly, once they started becoming involved. And so there were actually three bank, what were called holidays, that occurred within 3 years, when people could not convert their deposits into currency. So again, a lot of important things did happen. So the Fed, now that the war was over, has its shot at it. And this is, again, central planning, socialism, whatever you want to call it. Doing what the private bankers had done in the past. The Aldrich Vreeland Act, of course, was an act of Congress, but it worked great, an act of the Treasury. You didn't have to make this whole separate bureau, which has done a lot of harm. So the 1920s in the United States were a template for excellence disregarded thereafter. I mean, immediately by the – Hoover and his contemporaries were the first to – I mean, we get blood on Hoover's hands. If you've read my first book, Correcting Our Financial Miseducation, Raising the Bar for the Average, you know this. If you would like a copy, of course, you can buy one. But if you'd like one for free, just email me at my website, pauldayton.us. There's a little button you can push. Talk to Paul, email Paul. And just send me a mailing address and let me know you'd like a copy of the book, and I will happy to send you one for free. So, Hoover and those people get blood on their hands, so they start to veer from the proven course of success, right? The loose hand. I always talk about the tightening of the grip around the windpipe of the nation and the populace, or the loosening of that hand around the windpipe of the populace and the nation. So the loose hand had always prevailed, had always been predominant, often, not always, often been predominant for the country for so long, in such great prosperity, lifting people, the poor, not only the name, I was with the analogy of the of like a wedding reception. So there's different tables, right? And the name cards at the tables change, right? So, you know, Sally Jones started off in the poor table, and then went to middle class, or went to like super rich, and then went back down. It's a transient membership in the economic classes, the financial classes, which is great. But even the condition of what was called poor was elevated greatly, incredibly well, by such methods in this very country. And then they started going the other way. The politicians, once the New Dealers got in there, I mean, it was clear and obvious. Their strategy was to hold the people hostage with their own money. And that is a tactic that has, once it was injected in that way into American politics, and again, remember, taxation, total taxation as a proportion of GDP, as a proportion of the national income, had always been like around 10% in the United States, coming up to the New Deal period. During that time, the income, the proportion of the nation's income taken by government swelled to 20%. That is, it doubled, right? So the shackles on the citizenry was doubled during that time. And of course, we get to the great failure of socialism part two, which is the New Deal legislation metastasized into the Great Society and the ever-growing welfare state, war on poverty, where another 50%, so it went from 20 to 30%, up to now a third of the nation's income. And again, by the 90s, by the turn of the century, and even afterwards, I mean, we'd make it up. We're generally trending between like 40 and 45%. State, federal, and local taxation total consumes 40 to 45%, almost half of the nation's income. So it's important to briefly outline the decade immediately prior to the decade-long economic depression of the 1930s, as it illustrates well an almost perfect contrast of both approaches and of results. The 1920s were a decade marked by relatively low income tax rates, an absence of heavy-handed regulation, comparatively low labor unionization and union power, an absence of federal programs dispensing handouts for the healthy, the so-called safety net. There was no federal minimum wage. There was great industrial progress. There was an increase in real income for all income classes, an improvement in material quality of life for all, but particularly for those in the lowest income classes. By contrast, the 1930s, that is the New Deal decade, were marked by the opposite approach and the opposite results. Post-war inflation was handled poorly by the newly formed Federal Reserve Board, and the board made a drastic and sudden alteration in rates, as opposed to a slow and gradual alteration. And this drastic shift resulted in a very difficult transition year during 1921. This government-induced recession occurred during the Harding administration, led to 1 in 10 workers losing their jobs. Now, I'm going to pause there. So government creates a problem, right? They poorly handle the post-war inflation. They make this drastic cut in rates instead of doing it gradually over a period of time, which causes a drastic shock. Right? They use the word, you find the word shock if you do any reading on this often. So you use what's termed a shock to the system. which caused 1 in 10, that's 10%, right? 1 in 10 to lose their jobs. What was done? So now we're going to ask the question. What was the approach and what were the results? Answer, in absence of heavy-handed government wage controls or handout programs, firms adjusted by reducing wages and recovery was swift. By 1923, employment was restored. So that is, during 21, the government creates this problem. By 1923, it was fixed by the government just staying out of the way and doing nothing. Contrast that with the New Deal period, in which it goes on for a decade and never gets better. Right, so that's that. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, one of many measures of the American economy, although not the only measure, was at the level of 88 to 89 during the week in which President Coolidge took over for the deceased President Harding in August of 1923. The Dow would nearly double to 168 by July of 1927, and that level would itself double to 343 by October of 1929 as Coolidge turned over the party's candidacy for election to Herbert Hoover, the eventual winner of that race. Treasury Secretary Mellon's low rates helped to provide steady growth of the decade, along with the low jobless rate for the workers, as unemployment was a little over 3% in July of 1927 and just under 5% in October of 1929. On the topic of taxes, July 1921. So first of all, before I go on to the topic of taxes, the Dow has this explosive growth. We were talking about the housing market a few episodes ago with Samantha Knight Hansen on the show. And again, you can check out that episode if you're interested. We spent some time talking about the housing market and interest rates and what we think is going to happen. I predict interest rates. In today's interest rates will look very attractive in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. People will be wishing they gobbled up loans at 8% and 10%. Seems likely. Or at least they won't regret it. Seems likely. But that's just a prediction. But anyhow, so we're talking about that. But people say because the prices had swollen so heavily, and again, I pointed out with the shutdowns, the shutdowns of 2020 in the name of COVID, but it was just to create a crisis, a perpetual crisis. Again, what the New Dealers did, they just had a perpetual emergency, which they kept making worse, like an animal eating its own tail, just feeding into itself over and over again, making it worse and worse. The same is true of the COVID, what's called COVID shutdowns in 2020. They forbid production. They skyrocketed the money supply. So everybody could see, particularly people who have like some significant money, like much, much beyond me, it's clear and obvious that cash is bad. Get into stuff like real estate and gold. Was not a surprising outcome. So for a rush into real estate to cause an increase in the price is not a surprising outcome. Plus, we have prices continuing to stay high because of the artificially created inflation, which is occurring, which will continue to occur because they're not retiring the money they create. They're not. They're just not, unfortunately. I was calling all through 2020, banging the drum, just take the money back. Just take it back out of circulation. It'll all be fine. Don't worry about it. And, of course, that was not what anybody did. But people saw, so from in 1923, the Dow Jones was at 90, right? It was 90, which when you hear like the last few years have been like, you know, 18,000, 20,000, so forth. So nope, just 90, less than 100. And then so that's in 23. By 27, it was 170. By 1929, by October of 29, it was 350. So it's enormous. So people were sort of expecting, when there was not massive inflation at all, were expecting that to come down. Most people were. So when it did fall on the famous day, which was really two bad days, the reaction of government was the problem, which began with the Hoover administration and was exacerbated by the Roosevelt administration. It was not the couple of bad days that caused the decades of suffering. It was the government's reaction to it, just like the COVID monster inflation. It was not, you know, that 0.1% of Americans were killed by the COVID monster in 2020, according to the CDC. That's how much or how little 360,000 is out of 330 million people, 0.1%. It's not because of that. It's because of the government's response, because they shut down, they forbade production, paid people to fail to produce, and skyrocketed the money supply. They did it on purpose. So anyway, we go back to the 20s and the right thing. This is what we want people to do. The reason we tell people about this is I wish that people, that it would become politically profitable for somebody to run on such a platform. And this is what we asked Miss Sarah last week. I asked her, the New Deal was such a disaster, and I told her some facts, 15 to 20% unemployment, the failure for the war effort. I mean, she mentioned the war, Second World War. In 1936, the Spanish Civil War breaks out. In 1938, Hitler and the National Socialists of Germany, I guess we'll use today's term, they immigrate into Poland, and so on. I mean, war keeps going on. War keeps breaking out. The New Deal Congress, spend, tax. The shifting of the burden of taxation from the high earners and the corporations to the average person, which I do illustrate in the first book with a very good chart, that all occurred. And then, so this all goes on. They're taxing and taxing, spending and spending the New Dealers, but they don't have a standing army. War in Europe is for 5 years at least. It's going up, going on, going on. New Dealers do nothing. New Dealers do nothing. New Dealers do nothing. No standing army. And then on December 7th, 1941, bombs fall on U.S. soil out in Hawaii. Again, they're caught with their pants down without a standing army. It takes over a year to get an army together. And then they finally send them over to sort of mop things up in Europe in the European War is more or less what happened. I mean, for this, they get an A+. What's it take to get a bad grade, I wonder, from such an evaluator? So let's look at their superiors, the people of the 1920s. On the topic of taxes, July of 1921 saw the corporate tax rate increase from 10% to 12.5%. In 1922, President Harding dropped the top income tax mildly. It was 73%, unfortunately, and he dropped that down to 58%, which is still too much, down to 50% by 1923, which is still far too much, but nonetheless, the top rate was then cut in half, down to 25% by 1925, and this is really the key. By 1925, the top income tax rate was 25%, with the lowest bracket being taxed at 1.5%. Can you imagine out there? Imagine that out there. 1.5% income tax rate for the lowest earners. Could you, I mean, it sounds like a dream. 25% for the highest earners. I mean, shoot, most people pay an effective tax. Well, most people. I mean, I know I have historically paid an effective tax rate of around 25 to 30% myself overall. So, I mean, back then, of course, you see the superiority of what they were doing. The years 1925 to 28, those were the rates. And then in 1929, the top rate dropped down to 24%, which is more or less the same. It is worth noting that the amount of dollars paid by the highest bracket rose from $300 million to $700 million. Rising in terms of total tax revenue collected by the Treasury from roughly one-third of total taxes paid during the early portion of the decade with the high rates to nearly two-thirds of total taxes collected by the later years of the 1920s. That is, you lower the rate, you stop disincentivizing production, productivity, you stop stealing from people who are doing the right thing, treating them like criminals, right? When you have just government, the actual number of dollars taken in skyrocketed. Now two-thirds of the total tax dollars were paid by the high earners, and that when the bracket was only 25 or 24%, as opposed to merely being one-third of total tax dollars. So you think you're taxing the rich, but in fact you're taxing so that the poor can pay more taxes when you raise high taxes on the high earners that way. And of course, the poor, the less money, also pay in other ways, that is, there are fewer jobs to go around. Why would I have a business? Why would I expand my business? Why would I want to make more money when the government's just going to steal it from me? I'm not going to create any jobs. I'm just going to sit where I am. I'll sit tight, right? So the material quality of life for the masses improved mightily during the 1920s. Indoor plumbing was installed at the homes of the rank and file members of the American populace during the 20s. Indoor plumbing. I mean, imagine that. Imagine how much better you out there listening to this. Imagine a life without indoor plumbing, right? It was no longer a luxury of the, quote, rich. It was for everybody. I mean, and by the way, in China, by the 1980s, the masses did not have indoor plumbing. I know that. For it may have still taken longer. With all their central planning, confiscatory practices, and punishing people for being successful, putting people into positions that didn't belong just because they were good fighters. You know, it's like what Diane Sayre was on last week. If she wants to have socialized, you know, she wants to force people to have monopolized medicine, monopolized healthcare, which instead of having people in place who are competent in healthcare, instead you have people in place who are competent at government, basically fetching for votes and sleazing around back rooms and you know, that kind of a thing. So that you have people in positions, you're putting the people as a whole, the masses, at the mercy of people who are not in a job where they deserve to be. That is, you don't have medical people there, you have government people there, right? Same thing with agriculture, right? You don't have people competent in farming and food storage and preservation and pesticides and all that kind of stuff. You don't have people competent in that. You have people who are competent in government, at job, at office seeking. Right, and now they're there, and they have no idea what to do other than make unsubstantiated claims. And guess what happens? Productivity goes way down. The masses suffer. So anyhow, going back to the 20s in the United States, with indoor plumbing coming to the homes of the rank and file, I'm going to say it again because it's so wonderful. Radio was the new technology of the day, a luxury item only for the, again, the quote, rich, which found its way into more and more homes as the decade progressed. In 1925, about one in five U.S. households had a radio. But by 1929, the portion of households with a radio had swelled to 35 to 40%. 35 to 40%. Wonderful. As sales of radios in America rose from $60 million worth in 22 to $846 million worth in 29. Beginning in the 1910s, the dynamic growth of the new automobile industry, absent of rampant overbearing union monopolies, as well as absent of heavy-handed government regulation, brought a trend of steadily decreasing costs for new Model T cars, which accompanied an ever-increasing income for the American workers overall. The number of cars on the road in the United States ballooned from 6.7 million in 1919 to 23 million by 1929. It's incredible. The average earnings in 1912 were $600. The price of a Model T was $600. By 1914, the average earnings of the U.S. worker was $630 a year, where the price of a Model T was $490. 1916, the average earnings, $700 a year, price of a Model T, $360. By 1924, the average earnings of an American worker, $1,300 a year. Price of a Model T in the same year's dollars, $290. Isn't that amazing? I'm going to replace that with the word, government program, right? We're going to have a program for automobiles. We're going to have a program for jobs. Has a government program ever yielded anywhere near such spectacular results? You out there in the world, if you can name one, if you can even name one, it'll be, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens against one. But please, please, tell the world about it. Because I read these books, Schumpeter, and I read Karl Marx. You read these people. I always ask the question, where's the beef, right? They make all these unsubstantiated claims. They have all these, you know, predictions that never come true. They say that things will be better for the masses, when in fact they make it worse for the masses. They say things will harm the masses, when in fact the masses benefit. Look at this, unregulated auto industry, unregulated labor market. What do they get? Ever-increasing wages with ever-decreasing car prices, all by themselves. The problem for sleazebag politician class is none of them can take any credit for it. They can't say, I got you this program. I got you this job. I got you this. I did that. Instead, no, that's the only class for whom this is not beneficial. Another noteworthy occurrence in the 1920s, as is contrasted with the forthcoming decade and its cancerous economic legacy, which still ails the country to this day, was the triumphant moment in which the Supreme Court rejected a minimum wage law. In 1923, in the case Adkins versus Children's Hospital, a localized Washington, D.C. measure was struck down by the court on the grounds that such a law infringed upon the individual civil liberty to contract with one's employer and vice versa. I'm going to say that again because that's the correct answer. So this is not a federal minimum wage. It was just a Washington, D.C., you know, local minimum, regional minimum wage that had been that was struck down by the Supreme Court. Because, and this is 100% correct, such a law infringes upon the individual's civil liberty to contract with one's employer and for an employer to contract with those who they would seek to hire or who have hired. Now, I want to point something out. The people who are harmed most by the minimum wage are the least skilled and the least experienced. The abolition of minimum wage laws, the least preferred applicants, whether that lack of preferability is derived from a lack of experience, lack of skill, negative racial, negative racial, ethnic, religious, or gender prejudices held by a prospective employer or any other reason put themselves on sale in order to enter the job market of a particular field in the first place so that they may prove themselves, just the same way that a new business or a new product is placed on sale in an attempt to induce the customer to give that business a chance. A rise in price can come later after preferability among the customer improves, but at the outset, plain fact remains that 100% of nothing is nothing, and minimum price laws limit the least preferred to an earned income of nothing. And when we talk about the gender and racial prejudices, I mean, take the example of South Africa. In South Africa during the 20th century, many cases during what they call apartheid, which was racially based laws, the laws there were against blacks in particular. And what happened was, there was a minimum wage for whites. And so what people started doing was hiring blacks. Even though maybe they don't like blacks, maybe they don't talk to blacks, maybe they would never let a black, be a customer at their business, or whatever, no matter how much they don't like the person, right, just because of their skin color and for no other reason, they still chose to pay that person money, to hire that person. Why? Because the customer thought it was in their best interest to do so. I get the best price, the best performance for my dollar, I'm hiring them. Minimum wage law, so a minimum wage law would prevent such a person, the least preferred candidate, from getting a job. The same is true. People say, Paul, minimum wage benefited you, to which I reply, of course it did. When I got out of high school, I was literate. I was healthy. I was 6 feet tall. Like I was not going to be the least preferred candidate in the unskilled worker market, right? It's the person who is, not as healthy looking, not as tall, the person who's not going to get picked first for kickball. Right, that's the person who's harmed. I benefited, sure, because it made the other person less desirable. But I was working for, I'll just pick a number, $10 an hour. Somebody else might have done the job for $8 to start. The employer had to pay more money. The other person who was not hired got restricted to a maximum wage of zero, and they weren't able to enter the workforce in that case to try to, learn skills like how to be someplace when you're supposed to be there, for example, how to follow simple instructions. How to handle money, how to first get your experience with managing an income. All very, very important skills for anybody to go through through life and go through the job market. So we've reached the bottom of the hour here. It's 8:30 Eastern where I sit here in West Virginia. You're listening to D&P, Delivering the Truth and Exposing the Lies. Diana is not with us here this week, but she will be next week. We do miss her on the show, but she's always busy out there fighting and working on all of her committees and everything else. Our thoughts are with her. Come back, everybody. We have another half hour to go, and we'll be back in a couple minutes here on D&P, Delivering the Truth, Exposing the Lies on Freedomizer Radio.
Now, what do you think of the draft? I think America wants new leadership. New leadership. What kind of leadership do you suggest?
I suggest a wizard.
A what? A wizard, like Merlin, who could kill his enemies by wishing them dead. That's the way we'd like to beat communism now, by wishing it dead. The manufacturer wants more wars and lower taxes. Labor wants more consumer products in a 30-hour week. The college boy wants a stronger army and a deferment for himself. The businessman wants a bigger Air Force and a new Cadillac. The housewife wants security and an electric dishwasher. Everybody wants a strong America, and we all want the same man to pay for it. George. Let George do it.
Ah, I disagree with you. I don't want to let George do it.
You must be the exception.
No, I'm George.
Well, that's a hot one.
Everyone wants George to do it.
Except George.
No, everything's gotten so expensive. I'm going to starve.
Official sources say inflation is only up 7% from last year.
But the official index doesn't even count food or gas.
Transitory inflation is good and healthy for the economy.
How is it good to not be able to afford food?
Eating fewer meals per day is better for your health.
How are you going to sit here and tell me not being able to eat food is good for me?
You're out of touch, man.
You can't ignore this problem. Inflation is real, and someone needs to take responsibility.
You're right, man. It's his fault.
Huh? You're under arrest for shoplifting.
But we're in California.
How is inflation affecting you? Leave your comment below. Please like, share, and subscribe. And if you want to help us make more, donate at patreon.com/freedomtunes. Thank you.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever and whenever you're tuning in from, my fellow Liberty lovers. This is Amber S. from Living with Freedom Ministries, reminding you to tune in on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Central, noon Pacific time, for the Living with Freedom show, where we'll embrace what living with freedom can look like physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and in everyday life. That's 2 p.m. Central, noon Pacific, here on Freedomizer Radio.
Looking for something different? Looking for something fun? Join Dan every Monday on the Freedomizer Network, 9 to 10:30 Pacific, noon to 1:30 Eastern, for Common Sense with the Educated Redneck, Dan Ellison. The show about everything and nothing at all.
Welcome back to the show. This is Paul Dayton here on DNP, Delivering the Truth and Exposing the Lies. Dave Franklin and Diana, my co-host, will be on next week. If you're tuning in for Dave, just tune in next week. He had to reschedule. And Diana, unfortunately, did not make it, unable to make it tonight. But again, she's so busy with everything she has to do. She's on all these committees and with all these causes. It's amazing she finds enough hours in the day. But unfortunately, she couldn't make it tonight, and we do look forward to having her with us next week. So we are thinking of you out there, Diana. On with the show here. We've got the final segment here, and I'm going to spend a little time changing the subject to another matter, which is going to be socialized medicine or monopolized medicine, whatever you want to call it. I want you to talk about socialized medicine a little bit all around the world. So when you talk about people, the shysters out there with their unsubstantiated claims, they'll often, you know, talk about phantoms, things that don't exist, and say, well, you know, these variables like natural resources, like the population, like the topography of the area and so forth, which, I mean, those are important factors, and it's not that they aren't worth taking a look at, but what we notice when we start doing that, we take in the whole of the evidence, is that, you know, for thousands of years in countries of varying sizes and natural resources during varying time periods and in different parts of the world, the one constant is that the more socialized the country's medical medical and healthcare industries become, the more quality suffers and scarcity increases. And I want to point out, this is not unique to the medical industry. This is the same with every industry. It's the same phenomena over and over again, whether it's steel production, whether it's automobile production, whether it's agricultural production, whether it's medicine or anything you like, right? It's always, always, always worse for everybody. Many seem to regard a low nominal cost in acquisition as the sole objective, not realizing that the total cost to the citizens consists of tax transfers from the treasury to the medical providers, in addition to the cost of acquisition, as well as the cost of paying the bureaucrats to do the regulating, while also forgetting the cost may be higher in competitive cases because what they receive, what the person's receiving, the customer is receiving, is of higher quality or increased convenience. Filet mignon costs more than ground beef for no other reason than because it is better. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Let's pause there. Imagine if there was a government, you know, program in the name of helping the masses that made a uniform price for beef. And the uniform price for beef was low because the politicians don't suffer anything for that in the immediate term. They think they're going to play Santa Claus and appease some of the masses, ingratiate themselves with some of the masses, whether they're running for election or not. And so what will happen is if you set it, say the price of ground beef is the maximum price for any beef, what do you suppose is going to happen to better quality and better cuts? They're going to start disappearing, right? They're going to, I mean, it's the answer. Or they're going to be in such incredibly small portions. Frankly, what will probably happen is the producers will keep it for themselves and the public won't be able to have it at all, or it'll be commandeered by the bureaucrats and the government for themselves and the masses won't be able to have it at all. You know, you won't be able to have high quality stuff because the high prices make it worthwhile to produce high quality stuff, to keep it nice, to get it someplace on time, to keep, you know, to give it as much shelf life as possible and so forth. So this is, again, it's the same old phenomenon. Some people know these things, but some people don't, because the appalling popularity of nationalized or socialized, monopolized medicine pervades. So in the United States, I mean, the U.S. has been moving slower, further and further into the direction of both increased regulation and socialization, healthcare and medicine. Healthcare and medicine are different, of course. Healthcare is meaning access to physicians, surgeons, and equipment. Well, medicine refers to like medications and drugs, treatments. The Obamacare legislation, known commonly as the Unaffordable Care Act, was already touched upon in other areas on different shows, but it frankly had just a direct effect of merely transferring money from the Treasury into the accounts of the healthcare companies as opposed to reducing total costs. Milton Friedman, the great Milton Friedman, a 20th century American economist, pointed out in a 2001 study that from 1946 to 1996, so over a 40-year period, beds per thousand in the United States decreased by 60%, while hospital personnel per bed occupied multiplied ninefold. So that is, for every 1,000 beds that existed in the country, hospital beds, for treatment, for people who sought treatment. In 1946, there remained only 400 in 1996. During that span, however, the employees, hospital personnel, per bed occupied multiplied ninefold. Cost per patient day increased 40-fold over that time span, adjusting for inflation. In 1962, so during the middle of that period, the United States passed legislation introducing new regulations on the production of new drugs in the name of increased consumer safety. Now, consumer safety, consumer protection was sort of a buzzword, a buzz phrase that was popular for a few decades, politically profitable, sort of like the Ralph Nader phrase and that sort of crowd. From 1962 to 1980, so from the time the law was passed, for almost 20 years, new drugs manufactured fell by 50% compared to the pre-1962 levels. Fell by half. So we have taken the number of new drugs manufactured and dwarfed it by half. The other half are just eliminated from the market. By 1978, the cost of developing a new drug and getting it out for sale in the marketplace as measured in inflation-adjusted dollars had increased from $1 million and 25 months in the 1950s, which is, you know, nothing to sneeze at, to $54 million and 8 years by 1980. 8 years by 1908. All of the drugs and medicines kept out of the hands of consumers during these lengthy waiting periods certainly did not improve their safety. And in that way, the legislation certainly failed to live up to its promise of consumer safety. Increasing the cost of developing a legal drug for sale makes it, in effect, illegal to treat afflictions which are less common or rare. That is, the government makes it so they discourage you from doing it. It must be an act of private charity, right, on the part of the producer. So in other words, if you have $54 million in 1980 and 8 years tied up in bringing something new to the market, you have to feel like you're going to be able to sell it to enough people to not only get that money and time back to recoup your investment, but also to make enough more that it was worth it to do so. Because remember, you know, every single one of them is just like making a movie or something. Like, they're not all going to be hit. Like, they're not all going to have a big audience in the same way. So what you're doing is people who have like rare maladies and rare afflictions, what happens to them? What happens to the little guy in this case, right? The big crowd has the big problems, the big afflictions, and so treatments for that will be produced and available. Whereas somebody, if the disease only affects, you know, a small minority of people, then it will not be legitimately produced, you know, by a medical company, by a drug manufacturer or a pharmaceutical company, because they're guaranteed to lose money. Government made it so that treating such people, the little guy in this case, the least popular maladies, doesn't happen. And that's, again, not really helping anything at all. Certainly not helping the patients as a class, not helping the country as a class either. If anybody wants to call in, by the way, to the last few minutes of the show, 319-527-6208 here on Freedomizer Radio. Now, Canada is a country with a famously horrific healthcare woes right at the border to the north of the United States. Canada began their self-inflicted healthcare woes with their entry into monopolized medicine during the middle of the 20th century. The Commonwealth Fund conducted a study in 2007 to 2009 showing that 57% of Canadian adults waited longer than 4 weeks to see a specialist, while only 23% of Americans did during the same time. So again, we have that tight grip, loose grip on the windpipe analogy. The Americans have tightened the grip on the windpipe of the people, the populace, the country, in medicine, but Canada just tightened it, was squeezing much harder on that windpipe. So what's happening is, yes, it's worse in America than it should be, but look how much worse it is in Canada. The same study reported that the case of citizens seeking a physician for emergency, 30% of Americans were able to see a physician the same day compared to only 23% of Canadians, and that 36% of Canadians had to wait 6 days for an emergency physician compared with only 23% in the U.S. When it came to elective non-emergency, so again, this is freedom to choose, liberty, not being told what you may or may not have, right, by central planners and things being rationed out, doled out. Now, this is a funny, there's an interesting phrase, Peter Bauer uses it, and I'm probably going to use the quote in my next book, forthcoming book, says socialism, the gift that keeps on taking. But, you know, he mentions that children handle an allowance while adults manage income. Socialism makes children, central planning makes children of the populace by force. In the same way, you know, with this monopolized medicine and the rationing and the doling out of things, it makes beggars of the populace. If you're into freedom, or what's it called, my body, my choice, choice in medicine, so that's the t-shirt slogan, my body, my choice, that's popular with a lot of people. Expecting choice when you have a monopoly in effect is an exercise in idiocy. Beggars, by definition, cannot be choosers, right? They make beggars of the people. It's fascinating. The same class of people will often shout the t-shirt slogan, you know, my body, my choice, and then also have the t-shirt slogan of, you know, monopoly, health care for all, universal health care for all. Well, those are irreconcilable, of course. The person is showing nothing but a tremendous wealth of ignorance with such conflicting and contradictory expectations. Moving along here, waiting was the number one complaint amongst all respondents regarding the state of health care in Canada for 27% up to the north, while only 3% of Americans had a similar complaint, according to factcheck.org. The Canadian federal government taxes its citizens at a rate equal to 33% of their GDP. Now, these are income taxes alone, isolated. This is not total taxation. income taxes at a rate equal to 33% of their GDP as opposed to 24% in the United States, which is a differential of 36%. That is, if you started out with $24 and you ended up of every share of stock you bought, and you ended up with, you sold it for $33 for a share of stock, you made 36% of your money. So that's a difference of 36%. I often see people, they run into trouble with that because they'll do 33 minus 24. That's not 36. So I always explain that to people. 36% differential, 36% more of their GDP. The incredibly expensive health care has other effects on the economy. The public old age pension fund called Social Security in Canada has been rated to aid in covering, quote, the government's share of the cost. Of course, governments don't have money. Citizens have money. Money taxed from the citizens for their old age because the citizens were deemed by politicians to be too irresponsible to save it themselves is irresponsibly spent by those same politicians who have bungled the healthcare system by being foolish enough to buck the evidence of both history and of current events by supposing that public monopolization would perform in a superior fashion to the free enterprise system. Canadians pay a Social Security tax that is 2% higher, nominally 2% higher, 17%, as opposed to 15% in the United States. But Canadians receive a smaller check. It's only two-thirds the size. Canadians, $984, $1,470 for the United States. These are average checks. All of this taxation still leaves Canadians paying an average of $690 per year out of pocket for medical costs, just $400 less than their neighbors to the south. But what about the other common cost of public monopolization called scarcity, paying in terms of scarcity, shortages, ration, whatever you want to call it, is paying in terms of time, which is a type of money after all. We've already seen several examples of waiting times while resulting from the inevitable rationing of whatever the government attempts to control in lieu of the private enterprise. We're going to go to other parts of the world here. Record of socialized medicine is not restricted to North America. Tom Sowell, in his book, Applied Economics, brought forth several examples of the consequences. And by the way, I recommend that book. Thomas Sowell, Applied Economics, Thinking Beyond Stage 1 is an excellent book out there if you're looking for something to read. Several examples of the consequences of government control over the health industry in other parts of the world. In the Soviet Union, toward the later stages of its existence, before its house of communism collapsed upon itself, 80%, four out of five people of all patients were seen at neighborhood clinics in which physicians were to see eight patients per hour. Each patient was rationed their visit in 7.5 minute bursts. Five of the 7.5 minutes were spent on the paperwork demanded by the bureaucracy. Paperwork, which was often in short supply, by the way. So they're scrambling for this form that the person needs to waste their visit filling out, leaving 2.5 minutes for actual, like, dealing with the doctor. Brilliant plan. One doctor complained that, quote, our heads spin from rushing, end quote, and pointed out that, quote, we wind up seeing the same patients several times over when one thorough examination could have solved the problem if we had time, end quote. In 1987, his office, the man speaking, had still had a 1950s style fluoroscope. This account of badly outdated equipment is reminiscent of 1950s automobiles in Eastern Europe and Cuba in the 1980s and 1990s. Equality generally means equality of poverty. It's so true. So we're going to get off the subject of socialized medicine for a minute here, and we're going to talk about briefly the transcontinental railroads in the United States. Diane Sarah brought it up last week, and again, I thought we showed excellent restraint in not really rubbing her nose in every thing that she did that was false or even insulting. So she mentioned the building of transcontinental railroads in the United States as though it was a victory of central planning, a gold star on their report card. When in fact, it's one of the great failures of socialism. I mean, what you have is government comes in, and they have politicians colluding. So they make it such that there was a restriction, an artificial restriction on who could and could not be the ones to build the roads, and they also put attach strings to the money in such a way that people were not incentivized for doing a good job. They were just incentivized for taking the money. So in 1862, during the midst of the American Civil War, the Union Congress passed the Pacific Railroad Act. This act would grant politicians the ability to plan and build railroads with taxpayer money, and also for faux entrepreneurs to pose as businessmen. And in fact, they are nothing more than welfare queens. So what's called like the robber barons were really just welfare queens, right, during the 19th century. So again, this is government tightening its grip, creating, fostering, and perpetuating monopolies, creating these welfare queens. And yes, these people robbed people blind, which we're about to hear about. There were still grown men with real careers who during that time who served the public, like John Rockefeller and like James Hill, who we're going to learn about with the railroads here, and many others who did much better. I mean, the amount of the tons of people went to jail, as we're about to learn, during the building of the American Transcontinental Railroads, and they built roads that were really not suitable for use. It took, let's find out more here. So what you have here is the UP, the Union Pacific, and the Central Pacific was the other sort of line authorized by this congressional body. The UP was to begin in Omaha, Nebraska, and head west, while the CP, the Central Pacific, was to begin in Sacramento, California, and work eastward. The federal government was to pay each rail line 20 alternate sections of land for each mile of track completed, as well as to make cash loans per mile completed. The cash loans were to vary and to be determined upon the type of terrain the track was laid upon. 16,000. These are the 1860s, folks. I just told you in the earliest 20th century, the average American worker earned like $500 to $1,000 a year. So this is three quarters of a century later, the value of the dollar was such that people would earn $500 to $1,000 a year, like the average regular worker. $16,000 per mile in the 1860s was paid for flat track. $32,000 per mile for hilly terrain, and $48,000 for each mile of track laid in mountainous territory. So they're handing out land as well as cash, and it's just per mile of track laid. The fact that the railroads were to be paid per mile, irrespective of the quality of the tracks or the practicality of the route laid, created an incentive to prioritize speed above all other considerations. The UP and the CP were to meet in the middle, but no predetermined point was set at the outset, so that the race was on to build as many miles of track as possible, as quickly as possible, in order to cash in on that government payola. So you just have pigs feeding at the trough in the name of helping the masses. The UP line was built with chintzy materials, and sometimes unnecessary miles of track were laid and built to add unnecessary curves to the route, merely to rack up miles of track built since they were paid per mile. In 1869, the UP and the CP lines entered Utah running parallel to each other, and were paid by the government to do so. The workers of the rival lines engaged in violence towards one another, destroying track and even causing casualties. On May 10th, 1869, completion was declared. However, the hastily built chintzy lines had to be rebuilt and rerouted in many areas. Another 5 years would pass before the actual completion of the joint transcontinental line. Nonetheless, 44 million acres of land were paid out to the railroads and their boards of directors, along with $61 million in cash loans, which was an astronomical amount of money in the 1870s. And yet, even with all of the treasure gotten by the heads of the rail lines, the roads were nearly bankrupt upon completion. The reason for this can be very easily found in the fact that all of the individuals acted in their own self-interest and for their own gain, which is perfectly natural. But the problem was that nobody's money was involved in the financing of the railroad. One recurring lesson about central planning is that when the money is, quote, everybody's, it's also, quote, nobody's. And so the profitability, that is, nobody's watching the till like it's their money, because it's not really their money. And so the profitability of the railroad company, which was formed by capital investment of absolutely nobody involved, was of utterly no priority whatever. One such example of the types of behavior involved was the bilking each line by the bureaucrats running them for money by selling the rails low-quality building materials owned by their own private businesses at inflated prices. So that is, they didn't think about anything beyond stage one, like how is this railroad going to run once we're done building it? Is it going to be efficient with the use of fuel and things? You know, can we charge rates? Is this going to go through cities that are going to have traffic and give us business afterwards? Nobody thought like a grown man with a real career. They were just children thinking about, I get paid for my laying a mile of track, and I'm just going to take as much of that money as I possibly can. Greedy little pigs. It's pathetic. And so the people, of course, suffered. I mean, this is all at the public's expense in the name of their own benefit. So that, let's see here. In 1874, the UP got a new man in charge who paid a steamship company to – oh, and by the way, so I'm going to say that again. What these people were doing, the welfare queens, so the rails need materials, right, metal and you know, railroad ties and tracks and things. So what they would do is they would sell them – so they had a private businesses that manufactured that produced these products. So they jacked up the prices, gave them the worst stuff they had in their stock at inflated prices and built the railroads with those, all on the taxpayer dime. Eventually, what happens is the ICC is formed, which codifies monopoly and rate fixing into law, making a monopoly legal, an actual monopoly legal. A bunch of people go to jail. There is another guy called James J. Hill who built a private railroad, the Great Northern, in which other welfare queens had failed trying to build it. He bought it. There were five non-consecutive miles of track laid between St. Paul, Minnesota, and the West Coast, I think Seattle, Washington offhand. And it was the best railroad of all. I mean, it was built with his own with private money. The bosses were actually involved. They thought beyond step one, it was the only rail of its kind, transcontinental at the time, to not go bankrupt. It was profitable. It actually created a second steamship trade with Japan, which was very, very lucrative until the government went in and stifled that. We are running out of show. I can't give you any more details on that right now. I do want to thank everybody for tuning in to DNP, Delivering the Truth and Exposing the Lies on Freedomizer Radio or on iHeart or however you're listening to this. You can go to pauldayton.us to catch every episode of the show plus articles and hear me on other shows. You can check out Diana. Her health stuff is right there on the DNP episode archive page at pauldayton.us. You can check out the show on Facebook. That's sort of Diana's baby. And she does a good job keeping it with a lot of content. And again, thank you, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. We miss Diana. We look forward to having her next week. We know she's very busy. She's involved with so many causes and committees. Next week, we're going to have Dave Franklin, candidate for town council, District 6 in New York State. That should be a fun show. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm so glad that you all shared this time with me, however much of it you did. Please tune in next time. And if you're bored, go to pauldayton.us and check out an article or listen to another episode of the show. God bless you all. Stay free and have a great night.